This is Friday on the Other Side on Mind Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Fridays, we take a look at experiences and concepts that you might not think have a mental health component, but in fact, they do.
And today's guest has lived through the pain and confusion of a loved one's suicide. Sheila Hamilton lived a waking nightmare, more exposed than many, because Sheila is a 5-time television Emmy winner. She's a news director and a morning show co-host at a top-rated rock station in Portland, Oregon. Sheila is also author of All the Things We Never Knew, Chasing the Chaos of Mental Illness. Sheila Hamilton, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you. It's really good to be with you.
Well, Sheila, you certainly have written a book that is an important one. And, you know, but at first blush, when folks listen to sort of your resume, your life sounds like it's a charmed one. You have an exciting career. People know you. People recognize you. You've gotten all kinds of awards. But it, at a point in your life, that none of that really mattered and in some ways made your life more difficult.
Well, what's interesting is the year, I believe, that my husband was having a mental breakdown, I was awarded Oregon's Best Radio Broadcaster. I'd won multiple awards for my journalism. I was really in the public eye, and I wasn't sharing any of what was happening at home because it was so traumatic, and I hadn't figured out a way to talk about it honestly or openly, but it really just goes to show you that mental illness impacts everyone. It doesn't matter your economic status or where you are in the world in terms of fame and fortune. It's going to impact all of us at some point. 1 in 4 people have a mental illness in any given year, and 1 in 5 of us will be afflicted with a serious mental illness. So I think that it's something that touches everyone, and we need to be more open about it.
Absolutely. And what I'd like to start with is you introducing to us your then-husband, David. Tell us about how you met and what your first impressions were of David.
I was a television reporter for the local ABC affiliate when I met him, and we ran into one another at a coffee shop, and my first thought was just how magically gorgeous he was. He was 6'4", brilliant blue eyes, incredibly thick brown hair, and just a way about him in the world that showed his intellect and his charisma. I mean, heads seriously turned when he walked into the room. And he was bumbling with some papers in his briefcase and holding a cup of coffee in his mouth. And I thought he was the kind of guy that would be the antidote to all of the serious lawyers and doctors I'd been dating. I could tell he was a builder, and I asked him to bid a job because I actually needed a deck built at the time. And, you know, interestingly, he was very cool. He was not at all like a lot of other guys who would come on to me really quickly and push. In fact, he played very hard to get, and I don't know if he played that way or if he just was that way, but it made him even more appealing to me that he wasn't initially just blown over.
Well, and what you couldn't know then was that could have been an example of some of the mood swings that you later learned were a part of his illness.
Oh, I see so many things now, Pamela, in a completely different light. I see our initial meeting as a person who was disorganized, who might have been anxiety-ridden, who didn't actually follow up with a lot of the details in his life that were important because it was difficult for him to organize. I had the experience of my husband being alternatively extremely brilliant, so on point, so capable of carrying off the most incredible conversations and accomplishing the most amazing things, and alternating with this person who was distant, moody, dark, incapable of my reaching him, a person who could turn off love at a moment's notice, a person who lied, who cheated. And it was always my task in that 10-year marriage to him to try to figure out what I could be doing differently, when in fact that was the very wrong question to be asking. It wasn't what I could be doing differently. It what was it that he was afflicted by that made him act that way?
And it is very true, as you know, that so often when there's a challenge in a relationship, the woman is very often the first person to want to know what she needs to do differently in
sure.
order to make the challenge go away. At some point in this relationship, he was magically gorgeous. You knew he was a builder. So this had to be some incredible hunk of a guy. At some point, you folks married. And you described a really interesting wedding day. Talk about the conversation that you had on your wedding day, just before the actual service.
My sister, who is a Buddhist priest, she's very wise, really knowing. And she witnessed David the morning of our wedding as being completely checked out from the reality of what was about to happen. She described him as being almost in an altered state, that he wasn't relating to the beauty of what was about to happen, that he was in fact kind of unreachable. And she told me that, and it was just a few moments before I was to walk down and get married, and her words have always just rung in my consciousness, because she so accurately described the person he ultimately became when his illness really tipped over into the more difficult stages. She saw something very early in him that I just didn't, because I was so in love with him. And I think it's important for all of us to get the kind of feedback from the people who know us well right. about our potential partners and really take it seriously, because of course I didn't believe what she was saying. I didn't understand why she was making that moment of my life so difficult, and I brushed it off. Not that I would have changed anything. I don't think I would have. There's any part of me that would have decided not to walk down the aisle that day, but I would have stored it in a much different place, one of somebody with a lot of wisdom who loved me deeply, giving me a warning sign.
And you're right. A lot of times, if you're hearing what you don't want to hear, then you can very effectively not hear it.
Right.
And
yeah.
and you talk about the difference between the day that you actually saw and what the photos showed, which was very different from the day that you saw.
Right. So we have our wedding at a beautiful downtown hotel. It's in Christmas season, and the tree is just a gorgeous, beautiful decorated tree. And I'm walking down this amazing staircase that's a curled staircase down to this beautiful room with 150 of our closest friends. And it's almost like a fairy tale. It's so exquisitely beautiful. And when my father saw me, I was thinking how proud he was and how incredibly handsome he looked in his tuxedo. And there's a photograph that captures that moment when he actually gives me away to David. And in the photograph, all there is this intense worry on his face. And I don't know how it was that I created that he was so happy for me, because in my mind I created that my father was happy, when in fact the picture shows that he was extremely worried.
And again, we have the amazing capacity to not see what we see when we don't want to see it, and to create something different when that's what we feel we need to do.
Right. I was, I have to say there's a little bit of, I think it's the stigma around mental illness, which suggests that the person who suffers, and David was ultimately diagnosed with bipolar disorder, they suggest that they're always that person who is manic, or who is depressed, or who is a person who's incapable of loving deeply or contributing to society. When in fact, I guess the picture that I want to paint for people is that it's far more nuanced. His illness waxed and waned. We had many months together where he was loving and kind and the most interesting person I could ever have a conversation with. And then it would seem that the darkness would come over, just almost like the clouds come in Portland, and they would occupy the territory in his brain so wholly that he disappeared from me. And so it was helpful for me to understand that many other doctors say it's very difficult to diagnose bipolar 2, especially,
yes.
because people are never in hugely manic states. Their depressions are deep, yes, but they're not the kind of depression for instance, that I saw my mother deal with in her 20s when she locked herself away in her bedroom for several days. So I didn't know what I was dealing with, and I don't think it's uncommon, especially having spoken with many physicians who say you can miss it. It is not as evident as we'd like to believe it is.
Well, you know, and physicians can miss illnesses. How many times have physicians, you know, after the fact, commented on their own struggles with not having known that their partners or loved ones had any number of experiences? So you're absolutely right. It's easy to miss, and particularly with mental illness, because, and you talk about the stigma that continues to exist, perhaps not as much as it used to, but it is there nevertheless, that stigma can also help us not see what's in front of us. It's much easier to say somebody's having a bad day.
Sure, yeah. I think that, you know, David grew up in a family where mental illness wasn't an option. It wasn't discussed. Mm-hmm. It was seen as a moral failing. It was seen as a weakness of character. And I believe he carried a lot of shame around the thoughts and behaviors he was having. And he was not about to share those thoughts with other people. He was never going to be put in this category of someone with a mental illness because he's self-stigmatized. It's really important for me. I'm in a position in Portland where I could have gone on without ever bringing this incident in my life up. I managed to keep my really, really wonderful job. I met another wonderful man and remarried. And I felt like I needed to do my own part in busting open the secrecy and shame and stigma surrounding brain illnesses. There should be no difference in the way that we treat someone who suffers an illness of the brain, which is our most important organ in our body, than someone who suffers an illness of the pancreas or the kidney or the heart. They're just organs. They get sick, and we can get better. So that's the reason why I wrote the book. I felt it was really necessary for me to be one of those who says, let's stop with the secrecy and shame.
And, you know, in reading the book, I have to say that the way that it is written, which is a combination of certainly your own personal experiences and then your researched information, it really brings out the full flavor of not only what you as the loved one of a person with mental illness experience, but also what's happening in the world today and just some of the everyday challenges. A little bit later on in the program, we will certainly talk about some of the difficulties that you had with getting information, with just having access to what would have been useful for you to have access to.
Mm-hmm.
There came a point, let me back up a little bit. You have a child.
Right.
With David. And so as a result of David having an illness, you came to learn what was possibly a potential experience your child could have.
Right. We know a lot about the genetic predisposition, especially toward bipolar disorder. There have been lots of twin studies that show that as mental illness goes, it's probably one of the most prevalent for a genetic predisposition. The interesting thing for me is how much of that genetic predisposition can be modified by making sure that the person has a warm and wonderful and comforting lifestyle. If we develop at the very earliest stages the ability for a person with a genetic predisposition to bipolar to, for instance, learn cognitive therapy, to learn how to control the thoughts and behaviors in their own mind, we have been able to show in Oregon that we can cut the rate of early psychosis in these kids by half. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is very interested in this issue of how much can we alter the onset of these very difficult mental illnesses by preventing trauma, by preventing witnessing violent activities like rape, domestic assault, murders. What can we do for those kids who have experienced those traumas in terms of rectifying the impact of that trauma on their brain? And how do we as family members provide support and comfort to people who may begin showing signs and symptoms of mental illness? I've had doctors that have suggested my daughter Sophie's risk is anywhere from 50% down to 8%. I'm not interested in statistics. What I'm interested in is giving her the best, most fruitful possible condition that she can have to be able to deal with any kind of physical or mental challenge she comes up against. And that's the way I decided to raise her, was with a lot of love, a lot of support, and teaching her, you know, these coping skills for mental health that all of us should learn.
Absolutely. That's what I was about to say. When you bring your child up in a warm and supportive environment, that can, as you've just said, that can do wonders in terms of that child's well-being over time. And we do continue to have to be aware of the impact of early trauma on the creation and the functioning of children, of all, certainly, but certainly of children. At one point, David came to you and he told you that he was hearing voices that were telling him to harm himself.
Right.
What was that like for you when you had that conversation with him?
Well, I want to be very clear. David was in a really terrible place. His father, whom he'd had a very difficult relationship with, was dying. His business was going under because he'd been so frozen from his depression, he wasn't billing his clients. And I had just learned of another affair. We were in a very difficult place. And he went to a doctor friend of his and said, "I'm not sleeping. Can you help me?" And the doctor prescribed antidepressants. Now, for a person with bipolar disorder, antidepressants can be very, very dangerous.
Indeed.
And within 48 hours of taking antidepressants, David tipped over into mania. He was pushed over into a manic condition that included akathisia, which is this skin-crawling side effect that almost feels, he described it to me as being possessed by a demonic force. He said he had never felt anything as uncomfortable as this, and it induced suicidal thoughts. I still believe that more people need to know how important it is to get a correct diagnosis. He went to a general physician and said, "Help me." And instead of doing a full analysis of what was actually going on with him, looking at some of his history with the depressive episodes combined with hypomania, he might have been able to determine you need to see a psychiatrist and you need to actually get on a mood stabilizing medication for the short term. But instead, he was put on antidepressants, and the Journal of Psychopharmacology now says 50% of people with rapidly cycling bipolar disorder who are put on antidepressants never recover. They never recover from the manic episode that is induced.
Well, you know, the other thing that you bring up, which we don't talk about enough, I don't think, is lots of people have friends who are clinicians. And they will go to a friend, and a friend is not necessarily going to see a friend as clearly as one would hope.
Yes, I agree.
And
I agree.
So going to your friends is not necessarily the best thing to do. If you want to go to your friend to put a Band-Aid on your finger, that's fine. But if you want to go to your friend for a diagnosis or for medication, that may not be the best thing.
Yeah, it's a very good point. It was the tipping point for a number of things that really created a sense of hopelessness for David, because he didn't respond to any of the medications. He was hospitalized later for almost 6 weeks, and it really was just one medication upon the other. When I got his records, it showed that at one point he was on 13 different medications, and he felt a sense of so much hopelessness in that he never really did recover from that state, that the day after he was released from the psychiatric hospital, he took his truck to the Columbia River Gorge and he killed himself. And I just really want people to understand, we have for the longest time treated mental illness in our society as being able to be solved by pharmaceuticals. And I am convinced from all of my research and from the personal experience I had that it's a crisis of our entire entities. It's a crisis of our spirit. It's a crisis of our relationship. It's a crisis of our faith. It's a crisis of our mind. And we can't just expect one magic bullet or 13 magic bullets, as was the case with David's care, to solve it. we need to actually begin looking at the trauma that induces many of these mental health breakdowns and begin treating the whole person.
You're absolutely right. And so many times trauma is not even explored.
Right.
And it certainly needs to be. Sheila Hamilton is the author of All the Things We Never Knew, Chasing the Chaos of Mental Illness. We're going to take a break and we will return. Sheila, as I'm thinking about your husband being hospitalized at one point with 13 different medications, and at another point when he had attempted suicide, they hospitalized him for half a day, which I'm going to want you to talk to us about in a minute. But as I think about these range of experiences, I'm reminded of a time when I was trying to get a patient hospitalized onto a psychiatric unit, and a member of the psychiatric unit actually told me, this is a quote, "Your patient is too crazy."
Oh dear.
And wow. And so, you know, there is such an extreme range of services that are available, of awareness, I would say, even within the expert clinical community, that we all as individuals need to take as much of our own learning into our own hands as we can, just in terms of knowing what questions to ask, or asking questions, period.
Yeah, I completely agree. I have given many people whose children are in psychiatric crisis and whose partners are in psychiatric crisis this advice. If it's at all possible for you to arrange for an in-home recovery, right now I think you're better off. We don't have enough hospitals right now that are really geared toward patient recovery, toward instilling a hope in that patient that they're actually going to get through this and that they'll be able to live without disability. And so what I have, and many of my friends have been seeing happen more frequently, is to get the care and guidance of a psychiatrist, but to surround the person with the support and care of friends, to have the kind of security and the warmth of a home setting, to have the person be able to learn the tools of mindfulness and yoga and have healthy meals and sunshine and exercise, because the facility that David was housed in was worse than One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I couldn't believe that in this century we were still treating people with brain illnesses the way that I'd seen it portrayed in the movies. It truly was so horrific. Nurses behind bulletproof glass, people who didn't know his name, the idea that they were shoving patients in there just because with every new patient they got more money. That's how they made their money, the doctors who were on contract there. And there was such an abiding lack of care or compassion that I honestly believed it made David believe this was the end for him.
And tell us about the time that after a suicide attempt, he was deemed as treated and the issue resolved, and I think he was discharged within half a day?
Well, this was really speaks to David's charisma and his capacity to switch on and off his psychosis. It was very interesting for me to see that he could be in what I ascertained was full psychosis and ended up creating this situation where he made a suicide attempt. His sister took him to the hospital, and David convinced the intake physician that he was fine. He convinced him that it was just him playing around. He convinced him that, of all things, the hospital would be the very worst place for him. So there was a, I guess, you know, the number of places that David's care was just completely a total failure of care are many, but the ultimate insult was being housed in a place where nobody asked him, what were the conditions in which made you feel this hopeless? What happened in your life that created your sense of futility? Nobody talked with him about his father dying. Nobody talked with him about his business going under. Nobody gave him practical solutions for how to get out of debt. It was all focused on the psychopharmacology, and it didn't work.
You know, I have to say that in some ways I feel kind of sorry for psychiatrists today, because this is not what they went to school for. They didn't go to school simply to talk to somebody for 10 or 15 minutes and then give them a pill.
Right.
And it certainly speaks to the way the power, if you will, of insurance companies in terms of dictating and directing what kind of treatment should occur and over what period of time. And then, of course, the other side of that, I mean, you as a family member, you're at the mercy of these folks in the hospital who could quite legitimately be overworked, overtired. I mean, the whole thing gets to be so complicated. It's hard to say that one person or one thing was actually the person or the thing that led to your husband's death. But clearly, it was important for some numbers of people to have talked to him about the traumas in his life and what he was doing with those experiences in his head.
I completely agree with you about a system that is overtaxed, that is underfunded, that has completely lost its way. But I'm so hopeful, because there is a movement now in America with many hospital systems to say we're failing, our outcomes are not improving, our patients are still completing suicide, what are we going to do differently? And they're doing a compassionate model of care now in a lot of hospitals called the sanctuary model, where they not only have peer support so that the patient can talk to someone who's been through a mental health crisis before and who's come out on the other side, but that the recovery is going to be geared to the patient. So the patient participates in a way to say, yeah, I'm having this thing with my dad. I really should go see him one more time before he dies. Let's figure this out. Yes, I do need an accountant to help me work out what to do next with my business. So that's going to be the model that the most forward-thinking clinics move to. Will it take some time? Yes, because Oregon is building one now, and we're among the very first in the nation. But I do think it's the way that the model has to head, because we're having dismal outcomes with today's psychiatric centers. Dismal.
And of course, I think we really got to pay attention to what the power that insurance companies are permitted to wield in these kinds of things. Because as you're describing the model, I can hear the insurance companies, you know, sort of clicking off all the things that they're not going to pay for.
Right.
So that's a whole other conversation. I want to bring it back to your personal experience and your daughter's experience with your husband, her dad, as he was becoming increasingly more ill. What's your sense of how your daughter was impacted?
Well, the interesting thing is that I wrote this story in 2006. As soon as I landed from David's suicide, I knew that I needed to make sense of what had happened to our family and lay bare my contribution to not seeing it and not making the right decisions for our marriage. And then I put it away while I did all this other research on mental health and what are best practices. And I finally had a finished draft in 2011. And I asked my daughter if she wanted to read it then, and she said no. She felt still too raw from the experience. She finally read it last year when we were going on a family vacation to Europe. And she said, Mom, I think you'd be so shocked by how much of this I knew. I was only 9, But 9-year-olds pick up so much more than you want to believe. I knew you and Daddy were in trouble. I knew that your marriage wasn't good. I wish that you'd gotten divorced earlier so that both of you could have found a way to be healthy and find love. She dealt with it in a way that makes me believe whenever we as women attempt to try to keep a failed marriage together for our children, we're making the wrong. We're making the wrong decision.
Absolutely.
Those kids are so perceptive and so all-knowing. I honestly believed I'd kept so much of my pain from her, and she said there wasn't a part of the story that surprised her. Not one part.
Well, and, you know, I mean, it's almost hard to imagine how wise and aware children can be. And so many women do exactly that. They tell themselves, I'm miserable, but he's a good dad or she's a good mom.
Right.
And I need to stay for the child. And, you know, I routinely find myself asking clients when they're telling me what a great dad or mom that their child has, but how miserable that they are. I mean, that kind of seems like a disconnect.
Yeah.
And maybe we really need to take a look at what's really true in that situation.
Well, I think what's really true is that I did derive a portion of my happiness from watching him parent Sophie. I loved seeing him in a state of unadulterated bliss. He adored her. He was always a good father for her. And so I had a measure of happiness in watching their relationship together, but it wasn't coming my way. The love wasn't coming my way. It was almost as if he was incapable of doing that and deal with his mental illness at the same time. And so I do wish that I'd taken a measure of action earlier, because I think it might have saved him. I think if I had said 2 years into our marriage, either you get help for what I perceive as being a real concern with your behavior, or I leave, I think that he wasn't as sick back then, and he might have been able to be saved.
Well, that's an unfair burden to put on yourself. I think that sort of intellectually you know that.
I don't, you know, I think when you have had someone that you love die by suicide, every single option needs to be explored. What might have happened then? How could it have changed? He definitely wouldn't have had the one trauma on top of the second trauma on top of the third trauma if I'd moved earlier. He was physically in a better state. He was more receptive to wanting to see Sophie consistently. And if I'd said, you really need to get help or you won't be seeing Sophie every day, it might have made an impact. It's only to say, and my questioning of my actions is only to say, what can we do for the people we love who suffer from mental illness? Mm-hmm. We can't continue this codependence and hoping that they're going to find a way out of it themselves. They often don't, and it often ends as horribly as my situation did.
One of the things that, as you say, I think certainly got in the way for your husband was his family's view, and there are many families who have the view that mental illness is either doesn't exist or it doesn't exist in this family. It's not allowed. You have to be a man. You have to be a woman. You have to pull yourself up. I mean, there are all kinds of little tales that
right.
people will grow in their families that really do prevent people from reaching out for help. Very often when they know there's something up, they may not know what, but they know it's something. But reaching out for help is not as easy a thing to do as we would like. One of the things that I was really pleased to see with NIH, National Institutes of Health, NIMH, the National Institutes of Mental Health, was when they launched a whole campaign around men and depression.
Right.
Because certainly, you know, for years it was okay for a woman to be depressed, but it wasn't okay for a man to be depressed. So we do a lot to ourselves. As you were going through all of this, how was your work product being affected, if it was?
Well, the wonderful thing about my work is that it really allowed me to compartmentalize my grief. At the time that this was happening, I was on an afternoon shift, and so I would I would get up in the morning and be with Sophie all day and take her to school and volunteer at school, and then I would get ready for work, and I would be able to actually enjoy adult conversation and the entertainment business that I'm in and the news business that I'm in, and really focus on something that was very positive and something that I'm really good at, because I felt so inept in my own relationship. So in some ways, it saved me. It saved me to be with people who liked my product, who liked my work ethic, who liked what I did. It saved me to feel as if I was still contributing. It definitely saved me to be able to bring in a good salary that helped us claw out of the financial situation that David got us into. So in so many ways, it was a saving grace for me. On the other hand, when it really turned into crisis mode, I wish that I'd been able to take a leave of absence. I wish that I'd been able to just solely focus on David's care.
Were you not permitted that via your employer, or was that your sense that you couldn't leave the job for other reasons?
It's a sense of, in the entertainment business, there are 200 people underneath you who would like to snatch your job immediately. And if you leave for any length of time, it's very difficult, because they need to put other people in for you. You have to have somebody on the air for you in that position. And it was my sense that that wasn't a wise career move at the time.
Well, and as you said, you were really supporting the family financially as well. So to put that in jeopardy likely didn't seem like a good plan.
Right. At the time that David got very sick, I asked for the help of his family, few who lived nearby, and his mother who lived in Canada, and they came to stay with me. And what was very interesting to me, and this is just a warning for other families going through this, is there's a way in which once your loved one is in the hospital system, they pick and choose who they like as caregivers and who they want to be around that person. And they very much told me at that point, we don't think it's necessary for you to be involved. And I really believe that when a person is suffering from a mental health crisis, the more people you can get on that team
exactly.
to aid in recovery, the better. And we shouldn't be marginalizing or limiting any person who says, I want to help. We should be finding a way to develop an entire team of care for that person. And the hospital where Michael was seen, or David was seen, was exactly the opposite.
So it was the hospital that was saying that you as his wife, should not be involved.
That's correct. What they felt was that because we'd gone through these difficulties of him having all these multiple affairs, because I had talked with his mom about weeks earlier, whether or not it was time for me to actually separate from him, she felt like there was an enormous pressure that I brought in terms of his feelings of guilt and shame, and that I shouldn't be involved in trying to help him. And I have to say, it was the only thing that mattered to me at that point, mm-hmm. was to make sure that he got out of there in one piece so that he could still be there for Sophie. I knew that it wasn't likely our marriage was going to continue, but I was in his corner for his survival, for Sophie's sake. And I was very much marginalized. It happens frequently. I talk to many other families who have dealt with sons, daughters, in-laws, and they are cut out of the conversation frequently.
And that is, as you say, I mean, that's often the worst thing that one can do. We're going to take a break in a moment, but when we come back, as you went through this process and ultimately your husband did take his life, at some point you returned to work and you had a meeting with a very famous person who initially did not say anything to you that you particularly wanted to hear. So when we come back, we will start with that meeting with that person. Folks, my name is Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to The Conversation with Sheila Hamilton, author of All the Things We Never Knew, Chasing the Chaos of Mental Illness, as she talks about her experiences with a spouse who ultimately killed himself. We'll return in a moment. Thank you. Sheila, before we talk about the conversation you had with the well-known person, you've mentioned that David had several affairs, and I just want to take a moment to ask you to list some of the signs and symptoms that you later learned were all part and parcel of his bipolar illness, and certainly sexual acting out is one of them.
Yeah, hypersexuality, according to Kay Redfield Jamison, affects about 50% of people with bipolar, especially when they're in the manic phase where they're feeling quite grandiose and have a lot of energy and feel very sexual. I also now just put in a completely different perspective David's sensitivity to light, to the things that he wore. He could only wear 100% cotton. Any other materials really irritated him. To his sometimes complete focus on tasks in a way that was almost strange, like 10 to 12 hours of being able to read the same document or a book straight through, and then other times just a complete inability to concentrate at all. There were times during our marriage where David would pull up in his truck and pull over and get out of his truck without actually turning off the ignition. It was as if his mind was so distracted, so anxiety-ridden, so in that hypomanic phase that he was incapable of completing even just the most minute tasks. I now put so many of his characteristics, what I perceived as being a very kind of cute and charismatic disorganization, I now see as David's inability to organize his mind. I see his willingness to be so charismatic and so wonderful in group situations as part of that hypersexuality, because he also just completely turned it off in other situations where he had no ability to charm, no ability to relate, would walk out of parties without any explanation because he felt so inept and incapable. He suffered from a great deal of shame, and he suffered from a great deal of self-loathing, and those are characteristics of bipolar disorder. He had, toward the end, rages that were completely unexplained. He would erupt over the kitchen counter not being completely clean when his garage was a total mess. There was an inconsistency in the way that he approached me, from being completely, totally loving and sensitive and apologizing for the person he'd been to a person who seemed to totally abhor me. And all of those now I can frame in the context of illness. It was David's inability to actually cope with how much his mind was changing as the illness progressed.
And certainly, as you list these things, which in isolation sound pretty horrifying and enough to make someone pretty angry, in isolation, but as you recognize that they are part of an illness, you have a completely different way to think about them and a completely different way to respond to them.
Well, and you also stack that over the course of 10 years. It's not as if in the beginning I saw all of these behaviors all at once. It was as if I was piecing together a puzzle of who David was. And by the time I figured out the puzzle, it was too late.
Tell us who this person is. You know who I'm referring to, I believe. You met him at work, and you initially had an interview with him that you weren't all that thrilled about.
Well, Deepak Chopra was the guest who was going to be my guest the first day I came back from work from David's death. Now, imagine just the trauma of walking into your workplace when people understand what has happened to you and the looks you get in the hallway and other people who are completely emotional. So it was a very difficult day for me to begin with. And Dr. Chopra showed up, and it was so fascinating because in any other instance, I would have been completely prepared for the interview. I would have read the book the night before. I would have prepped on who it was that was coming in, but because this was the first day back at work, I was quite discombobulated. And it turns out Deepak Chopra was talking about his book, Life After Death. And so I began to talk with him, and I thought it was important that I tell him that my husband had just completed suicide, and this was my first day back at work, so that he might understand that I was in a more vulnerable position. And he didn't react. He showed no reaction at all to the fact that I said that. And when I probed him for the reason why he didn't react, he began to just tell me that it's because in his culture, death is perceived very differently. It's not. It's just perceived as this stopping point on this endless soul journey, and that we in the West have defined it in a way that's so final, so awful, so worthy of mourning and salacious, that he wasn't buying into the way that I was reacting to David's death. He explained it to me that he was on another chapter of his journey, and that was, it was a necessary part of who David would ultimately become. And it was greatly helpful to me. I felt like it was almost like a spiritual sign that Deepak Chopra was in my studio that day, because he framed my own searching for an answer in a completely different way, and it helped me immensely.
The ability to take in new information and observations when you are in such a crisis state can sometimes be quite relieving.
I felt like I had this open wound. I felt like I had an open, gaping psychic wound that day. And I felt more open to the possibility of change, to the possibility of this tragedy transforming me, to the possibility that I had a lot to learn that day than I ever had before. And that's why Deepak Chopra being delivered to me in some strange way was almost like the cherry on top of the ice cream sundae. I mean, it was in some ways kind of laughable that this person who is probably the biggest spiritual guru that I know of in my lifetime is giving me personal advice. And I took it in. I took it in, and it's been very helpful for me in my own recovery from trauma, in my own way that I deal in my life now, and the way that I continue to cope with my own struggles in my own mind.
Good for you. Good for you. At some point, you decided to go back and try to take a look at some of the hospital paperwork that existed about your husband. And you ran up against HIPAA, as you did several times, HIPAA being the law of the land in terms of protecting privacy.
Right.
Truly a double-edged sword, I would say. What do you think about HIPAA?
Well, I think it was passed for the, you know, it was the right intention. It seems that if you want to make sure to be able to protect patients and be able to allow them to have their privacy, there's a lot of good intention behind that. But it's gone so far that it's really getting in the way of most families being able to actually access care for their loved ones. I didn't know what David had been diagnosed with until he told me. I didn't know what medications he was on until after I got the papers that show that he was being drugged like a horse. I couldn't talk to his doctors about his illness because of his so-called privacy. Now, I have talked with so many families who are involved in NAMI, which is the National Association for Mental Illness.
It's a wonderful organization.
And they're working to try to reform the stringent notion of this bill that really prevents most people from having open dialogue about the kind of care their loved ones are receiving. We've got to actually understand that when a person is in this acute crisis of mental illness, they're not making decisions for themselves. It's very unlikely and very hard for them to make decisions for themselves. And we have to trust that family members are going to do the right thing and give them some degree of power in understanding what the illness is, in understanding the treatment plan, and in understanding the outcome.
You know, again, it's one of those double-edged swords, I think. Certainly, as a family member, it's important for you to know the diagnosis, it would seem to me. of your spouse. On the other hand, you know, depending on the situation, it could be an abusive spouse who would use that information to be harmful to the patient. On the other hand, if the patient is in jeopardy of harming himself or others, then perhaps the spouse does need to be made aware. And from what you describe of David, it was pretty clear that he was definitely in jeopardy of harming himself.
Oh, yeah. And you know, my situation is just not at all an isolated situation. I mean, you will hear this across the country from thousands and hundreds of thousands of families who are trying to actually access care for their loved ones, that they're prevented from getting them into care because most of the law is written around what the patient thinks is necessary. So you can have a 17-year-old or an 18-year-old in your house who refuses to get dressed, who has completely said over and over again that they're intent on suicide, that they're incapable of caring for themselves, and yet you still can't actually get them care in many states until 3 or 4 items are met. Now, when a mother knows that a child needs care, it should be quite easy to be able to do that. But the law has really been shifted in favor of the client so far that it's impossible for many families to be able to help.
So for those families who are listening now who may, in fact, have a situation where they've got a loved one either living with them or close by, who they're pretty clear something is up, but they don't know what would you recommend to them?
Well, NAMI is such a wonderful resource, and it's so prevalent now across the United States. It's an organization that was started by family members who were frustrated with not being able to get care, not being able to get information for their loved ones. So they're a wonderful resource. They have community support. They have individual support for all types of disorders: bipolar, depression, anxiety, PTSD, a special veterans group. Anyone who has a loved one that they're concerned about, the first place is NAMI. If NAMI isn't in your community, your local county mental health services can put you in touch with usually somebody who can step you through the system and show you the way in which you can actually begin to build a case for care for your loved one. Because it's not just the lack of access to care in our country, it's actually hurdling the number of things you have to get through to actually be able to get good care.
Absolutely. And the website for NAMI is NAMI.org, and it really is a wonderful website. Again, that's NAMI.org. So they're a wonderful first step, as far as you're concerned, for family members, for loved ones to approach, to begin to get a sense of the supports that are available to them in getting support for their loved one.
Yes, it's been a fantastic organization. And then just for people that are interested in a more holistic approach to healing, I would also check out the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care. It's a group of psychologists, psychiatrists, scientists, and people who are really interested in expanding the conversation about care beyond just psychotropic medication. So you'll be able to get a look at best practices in other countries, why other countries have better outcomes for mental health care than we do, and some of the wonderful research that's going on right now that's being funded by the foundation. So that's also a great resource.
And can you give us that resource again?
The Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care.
Okay. And you do writing, do you not? You have a blog?
I do. It's SheilaHamilton.com. And I'm also writing now for the Huffington Post in their mental health category.
So you are doing everything that you can to really reach out and let other people know what is available, that it's not so hopeless as perhaps many people think it is, and as it, I would think, felt for you at some points as you were going through your own journey.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure that I could do this if I weren't so filled with hope. There are so many wonderful changes right now in mental health care, including the move to the unity model, the compassionate model of care that I talked about, the willingness and the openness to actually engage people with mental illness in mindfulness practice and how that's changing their outcomes dramatically. In my practitioner friends who are seeing the most suicidal clients actually finally be able to stop their suicidality when they learn cognitive behavioral therapy. And I've included all those really hopeful pieces in my book because I don't want people to just read the book and feel as futile as I did.
Yes.
I want them to understand there's hope, there's recovery. There are so many amazingly dedicated practitioners who are just blending the very best medicine with the idea that you can recover from a mental illness. And that's what I hope people will take away from reading the book.
Well, I suspect that they will. And again, the name of the book is All the Things We Never Knew, Chasing the Chaos of Mental Illness by Sheila Hamilton. Sheila Hamilton, thank you so much for joining us today on
thank
this
you.
Edition. My pleasure. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. You can listen to this program again and to all Mind Talk programs on demand at myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace treatment or consultation with a medical, mental health, or other professional of your choosing. The managing producer is Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. You are encouraged to send your questions or comments to me at myndtalk@AOL.com. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. I hope you will join me next week for another edition of Women's Wednesday. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.